My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Hello? Hi? How are you? Hey, is anybody there?
Well, hit me this morning like slap in the face. I think it's high time I left this terrestrial waste. I'm gonna hide a face. Yeah, I'm gonna hide a face. Well, you can have my butt and keep in my face, because it's all me needing them out of space. My roommate mom went to bound on her face. She said she must do pretty far to get to my race. I'm gonna hide her face. Yeah, I'm gonna hide her face. Well, left out of work, but a smile on her face. She's a sex.
Hey, baby, I'll meet you getting out of space.
I'm gonna hide her face. I'm gonna hide her face.
All right, here I go.
Good morning to you, good day, whomever you might be, wherever you might be as you listen to this radio program. Welcome to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Good to be here with y'all. I am extremely excited about the program tonight. A special New Year's edition of Radio Orbit. And so happy New Year to y'all. Just about an hour from now, actually, Central Time. But before all of that excitement, a quick thank you to Corey. New Wave Radio Theater, every week before this program, 1 hour, 10 p.m. Corey does it, and you can hear her again next week at the same time. New Wave Radio Theater. Thanks, Corey, and have a great night. Have fun, okay? Yeah, Happy New Year. Before Corey, Kelvin and Jason. They do it up. Of course, today it was Kelvin and Kelvin. Jazz plus blues equals flying saucer radio. Tech radio, they keep us up on the amazing, ever-changing landscape of high technology. And Jeff Wheeler starts things off with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Good music, good talk, good news. A radio revolution on a chilly Monday night. Moon, a little less than half full, sliding away. Amazing full moon last week, along with the solstice, about a week or so ago. And some amazing formations up there in the heavens to accompany all this. Today, of course, tonight, the 31st of December, 2007, is about to roll over. And you're listening to it here, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan, and program is Radio Orbit. Glad to be here with you and a part of it all. Thanks to all of you who joined us last week. A big thank you to our friend, Stephen Herod Buhner, for a wonderful talk. Hard to say enough good things about Stephen. He's just magnificent. So thank you again to Stephen Herod Buhner. On the web at Gaian Studies, G-A-I-A-N, studies.org, gaianstudies.org. The music last week also from the Starlings, wonderful good time music out of Kansas City. Thanks to Joy for sharing that with me and letting us share it with you, too. All right. By the way, all of the musicians featured on the program, some of which just walked in the door, as a matter of fact, can be found on the website right over there in the music archives section. I should say this evening, we'll be featuring the music of the Hootin' Hallers. Just walked in the door, as a matter of fact. Just got done playing some music down at the Blue Fugue, where there's a New Year's celebration extraordinaire happening. And we'll have another one from the Hootin' Hallers in just a minute here. But if you missed the program last week, or any other for that matter, you can always get them after the fact. The Richard Allen Miller program, by the way, from the 10th of December is up and in the archives now. Some people have been asking about that. I had some problems with the original recording, but everything's cool now, and you can go grab that from the archives. And all the other ones, except for a couple, are up on the web, all right? Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com, in the program archives. Slip on over there, see what you think. And if you find something you like, share it with somebody else. Maybe they'll like it too, okay? All right, tonight, the amazing Paul Laffoley, a master painter, a visionary, a futurist, the most awesome architect I've ever seen. He's been on the program a couple times, both earlier this year. He's one of my favorite guests, and he's here on the program again tonight. A lot of folks always enjoy hearing him talk. So we'll do it again in just a few minutes with Captain Midnight himself, Paul Laffoley, on the web if you want to get a leg up. www.laffoleyarchive.org and also www.laffoley.com. Laffoley.com. All right, you'll get a taste of what I'm talking about and you get to see some of the concepts and artwork that we'll be talking about with Paul in just a bit here, okay? All right, as I mentioned tonight, returning musical guests, the Hootin' Hallers. We'll have them tonight with Paul Laffoley. We started with a song earlier that was written in honor of Radio Orbit, actually. It's called Outer Space. That's how we started the program off tonight. We'll have another one right now. This one is called 40 Ounces to Memphis. And you can find information about these guys on the web at www.mikehagan.com. Just click over to the music archives, and they've got the MySpace thing and all that going as well, okay? All right, once again, 40 Ounces to Memphis. This is the Hootin' Hallers from their new CD, recently released, called Friends. I don't know if they got any of them, but they say they do. Usually they buy them off with booze or drugs or something like that, but that is, actually. That's how I got to know them, as a matter of fact. All right, back in a minute. It's Mike. Listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM.
All right, everyone bring their A game.
Yeah.
All right. 40 Ounces to Memphis, the Hootenhowlers from their new CD. It's called Friends. And speaking of friends, they are them. And they walked in a few minutes ago, and we're going to ask Paul to be kind and patient. And let me say hi to my buddies here, Johnny, Andy. Hi, guys.
How you doing, Mike?
What's
Thanks
a lot, Paul.
Thanks,
and,
Paul.
And Paul Lafley's on the line here, too, with us, and we'll say hi to Paul. You don't have to be silent back there. These guys are playing music down the block tonight, Paul, but they stopped in to say hi before they went back to the bar.
Oh, hi to everybody. It's already 2008 where I'm sitting.
Yeah, he's in Boston and already watched the ball drop or something like that, I guess, in New York City. So
I mean, but I've never understood why there can't be a single time the entire Earth. Yeah, it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's dark or light.
Yeah, so celebrate at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, because you'd get used to, say, if 5 o'clock was high noon in some place, then you'd start to think of that as high noon. But they don't do it.
Hey, let's start it tonight, right now, as a matter of fact.
Right.
11:15 is the new 12 o'clock.
So Johnny and Andy from the Hootenhowlers here, they got a new CD. It's called Friends, right?
Yeah, we have Friends.
I know you do. There's a whole bunch of them here in my studio right now. And
who's our first?
Great music that you've recorded, and you did it on your own. And
we did it all by ourselves. Well, we didn't do it by ourselves, but
a lot of help.
We had help.
Essentially, most by ourselves, though.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're gonna feature music from your CD Friends for the rest of the program here tonight, and I appreciate you guys sharing it with us.
Well, I appreciate
and,
you.
They just got off the stage at the Blue Fugue down on 9th Street, and there's a lot of good music happening down there for the rest of the night. And if you're tired of listening to me and Paul Lafley talk, which I imagine will be difficult, you can go down there to the Blue Fugue and watch some great music. And the Hootenhowlers is always out and about around Columbia here, and you know, in sort of this particular region. But great new independent music, and these guys have been doing it for not a long time, but really coming together. I appreciate what you guys are doing.
Thanks a lot for letting us come down.
Yeah,
and don't forget free shots of chartreuse after midnight.
Wow, free shots of chartreuse. That's hard to say. after midnight at what's that? 9?
She sells shots of chartreuse down my seashell.
All right. Down at the Blue Fugue. They're having a good time, and you guys can join them down there.
Hey, we're also playing a free show on the 23rd.
Where
29th
at?
Of 29th.
29th of January, where?
February.
At the Blue Fugue, where else?
Oh,
at the Blue Fugue.
In February.
Uh-huh. It's
wow.
The Hootenhowlers Night of Nonsense and Mayhem.
All right.
And it's
nonsense
all free.
Wow,
I'll be a part of that for sure.
Cool.
All right, you guys, take care of yourselves. All right?
Happy New Year, Mike.
All right, once again, the Hootenhowlers, you can find information about them on my website and, like I said, MySpace and all that stuff. All right, so let's get back to business here, and we will say hello to Paul Lafley. He is an amazing architect, a designer, a brilliant painter, a visionary futurist. He has some remarkable ideas and maps for an exciting and hopeful future. He's one of my favorite guests here on Radio Orbit, and he's with us again tonight from his studio, I'm guessing, in Boston, Massachusetts. The wonderful Paul Lafley. Welcome back, Paul, as always. It's a great pleasure to have you.
Hi, thanks. And I just want to start off saying that 2008... adds up to 10, adds up to 1. So it's a year of change for almost everything.
So
yeah, in numerology, the number 1.
Yeah, so the number 10, in other words, the digital root of 10, 1 plus 0 equals 1.
It's 1, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So talk a little bit more about that, the significance of the number 1.
Well, it's like day 1, things start over. So that's the essence of change.
Mm.
And so if you've been having any trouble, it's going to change. Maybe to some different trouble. But it's going to be different.
Right, but at least not the same old
exactly.
Trouble.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, they say nothing stays the same except change, right?
Right. But that's a paradox.
Yeah, because it is weird. In other words, it seems like, for the most part, the big picture stuff has stayed the same for quite some time.
Well, I think you're going to find that that's not going to happen now.
Mm.
Because, like, it's like time is on a Mobius strip, you know, where it's going forward, but then you come back and everything's reversed.
Because,
like, if you run a shadow over a Mobius strip that's asymmetrical, when you get back to where you started, you see the other side of a shadow. that's part of what it's like to be involved with time, is to enter an incredible paradox, because nobody really can define time at all. I mean, Saint Augustine, you know, said we can always tell what it is, but we can't define it.
Hmm. Like gravity, sir.
Pornography.
Yeah, one of the questions that I had on my list was to talk about time and the idea of time as a nonlinear wave. And you have certainly your ideas about that. You want to expand a little bit?
Well, we're getting to the next form of mathematics will be beyond topology, because topology still has to do with spatiality.
Hmm.
And but it is the only up to this point, it's the only form of mathematics that comes close to getting to the nature of temporality. But there will be a leap, and then we'll be able to have a real nomenclature for temporality, because spatiality is feminine. You divide it. Remains passive while you're doing that, whereas the time is active and masculine, and once you get in relation to it, it starts to bore you, so that you don't actually you can't figure out what the hell's going on. It's like meditation, you know, like it's planned boredom. So that when you come back to your regular life, everything seems exciting, and so that the number of years you can keep meditating, the greater the bounce back. It's like what happens to people when they lose their REM cycle, and then they don't dream for years, and then suddenly they start dreaming, and the dreams are incredibly vivid, and they don't know what's going on from that point.
Mm-hmm.
Even the concept of time travel is based on a spatial structure. You know, time travel.
Right.
You don't travel in time. You travel in space.
Right.
You know,
right.
You go from.
Right,
from
put a spatial word on it to define it.
Yeah. So that we have literally utilized all the subtleties of spatiality to describe something that needs its own nomenclature. I've been trying to work on that, and I think that it's going to require a revolution in mathematics.
Hmm. You know, my old friend Terence McKenna used to say that the world is made of language and linguistic intention and this sort of stuff. Words are what we should be so concerned with, because you can't go somewhere that you can't describe.
Yeah. And so that to get to the essence of temporality, you've got to absolutely cut out all your spatial metaphors in the way you speak about it. And for most people, that means they can't say anything. So therefore, the discussion stops at that point. And
yeah, it's a lot harder than it sounds, right?
Oh yeah. I said, if St. Augustine had a problem with it, I think we're going to have a problem with it.
Mm.
But that most people know that time exists, and people who do things like saying, well, time doesn't exist because you can't define it, and this kind of stuff, are misunderstanding the function of language. I mean, language doesn't produce the experience. It simply describes the experience.
Right.
And so that
And so language is always lacking as well, right? In other words, it's always wanting.
Yeah, because it's a creative thing, like anything else. In other words, it's not something that stops at a certain point in history, you know, and then you go on and think you can build on that. So the thing is the same with mathematics. Mathematics is creative as any other thing that you're doing, and it will not evolve, but it will creatively change. And so that since we are moving into outer space, we're going to need that change.
And so mathematics, you see that as sort of the leading edge of intelligence? Mathematics as a language?
Well, no, it could be. It depends upon where you want to go. You know, like in the Renaissance, easel painting became the leading edge.
Mm.
And that's because of the concern for perspective.
Yeah, which didn't even exist before then. Isn't that
well,
a strange
it
thing?
Did in a sense. It was the it was part of a wall decoration in Roman buildings, and so but they didn't think of it as anything other than decor.
Mm.
So in other words, the potential of it came about during the Renaissance with the with people like Paolo Uccello, you know, who would in order to demonstrate what the potential of a perspective is, that he drew what he thought people in Florence would see every single day, which was a chalice, you know, where they take Holy Communion.
Mm-hmm.
So he takes the chalice and he holds it up next to a drawing that he made of in a perspective drawing, and they didn't get it. They didn't know what the hell that was. and yet now we can look at it and we can see that it was an accurate rendering of a particular chalice.
Mm-hmm.
So the world had to catch up to that. Now of course today, and anyone can understand perspective.
Man, Paul, what do you make of that? Okay, we're talking about perspective here. It's something that, for the most part, wasn't recognized, at least, as useful until 500 years ago or so. Then you've been talking about St. Augustine a bit. And I know the story about St. Augustine where he, in order to sort of verify his divine inspiration or something, he used to look at the Bible. He would go into churches and places, and they would open the text, and he would look at it, and then they would close the Bible, and then he would recite it out loud, and it blew people's minds, because up until that point, nobody could read silently. They could only read aloud, and he was one of the first people that could apparently read silently. You know, now,
because that was part of the oral tradition.
Right, but now it's no big deal. All of us can read silently. But this is the same human mind, the same human
physiology. Well, that's
physiology,
not actually quite true. Because the behaviorists have examined people in certain behaviors and have shown that when a person is reading silently, they are reading so... in other words, the decibels are so low that it doesn't disturb other people, so they think it's silent.
Uh-huh.
So that you actually are reading out loud, but you're not yelling out loud.
Mm. What about mouth movements and the the exhalation of air?
Those are all air.
But just very small.
And it's probably necessary in order to do that, because it has to do with touch, which is the ultimate sense.
Uh-huh.
So that when you're hearing, you're being touched by sound waves, and so you're responding to that.
May I ask you what you think about language in general? The fact that many evolutionary biologists and these types of people say that language evolved in our species, maybe 50,000 years ago, plus or minus, but those same people say that physiologically, anatomically, we've been basically the same for 150,000 years.
That's right.
So what do you make of language, spoken language, I guess?
Well, it's probably, we didn't need it that soon.
Hmm.
Because if you're living in a very primitive environment, you probably used your eyes a lot more than ears. And so that like take in any animal, that they're observing their enemies and then making yells to warn others. but not to, because if they yell, then they'll be eaten because the other animal will know where they are.
Right, right. So, right, the one that yells is the one that's in trouble, right?
Exactly. So that the when it became necessary to do the kind of abstract communication that we call talking, it was because the environment had altered, probably through our efforts, but other situations, just like the gradual increase in population. Because even in at the time of Leonardo, in Florence, there were only 30,000 people. You know, see, it was pretty close to the time of Dante.
Yeah,
which was even less. I mean, that's like a little tiny town today.
Right.
Now our population is like we're moving up to 18 billion people. So that's probably the reason why people are so concerned with telepathy, because telepathy moves you into a communication mode at the speed of light, where as opposed to standing on the tops of mountains and yodeling and then calling across from one to the other, waiting for the sound waves to go at 600 miles per hour, whatever they do, you know, to get there. You got to be faster than that.
Right, right. Well, I just wonder where everything is going. You know, Paul, we talk about the future a lot, and there are a lot of people that are asking about space travel, and we sort of touched on that idea a little bit already. Let's talk a little bit about what you think of space travel, and for that matter, space colonization. The reason that I got this question in mind, I had a listener send me this link to a wonderful old video collection that I was able to purchase from Buckminster Fuller. It's called The Lost Interviews, Bucky Fuller, The Lost Interviews. Anyway, and as I watched some of this, it turns out that he believed that even 20 years ago, that if the technology that we had at the time was utilized correctly, that a great majority of the solar system could be habitable. And I don't know, I'd just like you to riff on that for a while, the whole idea of space travel and colonization.
Well, I think that we're now, it's kind of obvious that the speed of light is transcendable. I mean, it's variable up and down the scale, you know, like that. I think the last time I talked, I talked about a woman physicist at Harvard who has gotten the speed of light down to 17 miles per hour. And then this was like probably 6 years ago.
Right,
and she's now getting it down to 4 miles per hour. Okay, now on the other end, that the speed of light that was measured by the Michelson-Morley experiment in the late 19th century was close to the surface of the Earth. It involved something that was filled with material, you know. Whereas, to say, if you go into some parts of outer space, you reduce the amount of material by great factors, so that within that you can then have light go at higher speeds than the so-called speed of light. The speed of light was just in a definition of a vacuum close to the surface of the Earth. But if you run light through water, you slow it down. That's what creates the angle of refraction and that kind of stuff.
Right, I see. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that if you go into an area where there's less and less stuff, then there's no limit to what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that as a way of getting to other places, we're going to have to do that, and also along the way, we're going to have to build structures that are light years in extent, you know, not like like a golf ball being hit from the Earth and then landing on another planet and then you go to the other planet and you hit the golf ball again. No, you want to have bridges that go through space, and so that you can then have people living between them. You can have generations, but the thing is that will actually speed up the capacity to move around. Then because light seems to have no limit to its velocity, you can then do you can then outrun a black hole, because because gravity builds up around a black hole, and then the light gets sucked in. But that's only the definition of a black hole with the speed of light at the surface of the Earth, which is not really what's going on. So that you work with light that can go many times higher. In other words, like instead of C to the zero power, or C to the one, or C squared, you can see cubed and C to the fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Then those that you base a velocity of movement on those factors, then you can get there so fast that you're not going to have any of those things that Einstein talked about. You know the twin paradox.
Mm-hmm.
Again, those are all based on assumptions
that
the speed of light mm-hmm. was fixed,
right.
And the fixedness of it had to do with the Earth. So he was again as stuck into an Earth-centered theory as people say that Dante Alighieri was when he did the Divine Comedy.
Hmm.
In other words, it was an Earth-centered notion.
Mm-hmm.
The universe doesn't care about us. You know, I mean, it's out there for the grasping, but as long as we know what to hold on to, and so I think that we've got to spread out in all directions as fast as we can, before we can do things that look like Buck Rogers again,
mm-hmm.
because Buck Rogers stuff again is based on what we think the Earth's all about when we displace it.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Hoagland, you know, for the guy that used to be a PR person for NASA.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You know, just came out with a new book. You know, Dark Mission, and he's proven that there were structures on the moon. You know,
yeah,
crystalline
yeah.
things. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, of course he for years he fought for the face on Mars. Now that means that other guys were coming the other way towards us, and like, so how in the world did they get there and have enough time and enough energy to do what they did? So it means that we are limiting ourselves by a notion of how fast you can go.
Hmm.
And I think as soon as this totally recognized that the speed of light has no limit. In other words, it's infinite. In other words, it can be infinitely small or infinitely large.
Mm-hmm.
That we will have the goal, our goal of travel through the universe affected.
Paul, do you think that there was anything? It seems weird to me that we went to the moon, and then it just sort of stopped. And it seemed like, you know, space exploration.
Why did they stop?
Why did they just stop? I mean, the technology that's being used even now for, you know, the space shuttle or whatever rockets that launch satellites into orbit. I mean, it's no different than it was 50 years ago, essentially.
Yeah.
Why did it stop when everything else advanced so greatly in the last 50 years? Are they up to something, or are we being told the truth?
To me, the logical answer to that is that, you know, from the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still.
I love that film.
I've seen that over many times, over 1,000 times, and it's like that they're out there, they've been there for billions and billions of years, doing a lot of stuff, and we're just emerging from a kind of, you know, like an Eden, a cocoon, and have yet to take our place in the universe.
Might
and,
the bigger
and so,
picture. Yeah.
And so they're funneling our information, you know, dropping off some thoughts here and there, and then proceeding that way. And so if you start doing something, and it gets cut off, then my thought, it's obviously the wrong way to do it. Because if you have solid or liquid fuel that's like a gun, you know, you're still back in the days of Jules Verne.
Right.
Because like from the Earth to the Moon, he modeled the ship as a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that kind of stuff. So that there needs to be another way of thinking of how you get there.
Right, right.
I think that I think I talked about before the last 10 years of Nikola Tesla's life.
Oh man,
that was in the New Yorker hotel in room 327. He always wanted to stay in a place where the room number was divisible by three, and everybody said he was washed up and he was just picking up pigeons in Bryant Park and bringing them back into that place, but he was actually thinking of other stuff, and one of his main ideas is the concept of clothing in different environments. And the necessity for something that would work in all places, because like when in a lot of science fiction movies, the first clue that you're in one or watching one is that the people from the other worlds all dress alike. You know, I mean, they
right.
have no style.
Right, they all wear silver suits.
They don't
suits,
go
sir.
Beyond a certain thing. You know, like it's artists in Chelsea. You know, they all wear the same thing. You know?
Yeah.
I do that. You know, all black with a head shirt.
Right. Yeah. The guys from Zenobia Genubi, they're all wearing silver suits. You know, or whatever.
Right. So what Tesla was talking about is a way to have clothing that doesn't depend upon covering up your body. I mean, in the sense that you would do that for simply for modesty, but
so the
modesty clothes could be subject to style changes, whereas that if you activated the human aura to a point where it would resist temperature change, it would resist missiles hitting it, you know, and all the rest that you could walk underwater, you could walk into outer space, you could go into areas where it's 273 centigrade below zero,
right,
you know, as
right.
so-called absolute zero,
right, right.
And not be affected by it, because a lot of times you see people that are drawn as like practically nude, coming from other planets, and people say, "Well, that's pretty stupid. You're supposed to put on something that looks like a 1930s diving bell outfit," which is what NASA ended up doing.
Right,
and so
right.
you got all that crap all over you.
Right, the big helmet and all the
right.
Yeah,
and it's awful. You know, especially when you have to go to the bathroom in one of those things.
Right, right, right. You want to be comfortable.
Exactly.
Right. And Nikola Tesla was working on this.
Yeah,
amazing.
And so that makes total sense to me, because, you know, like take the case of Eric von Doniger. You know, he based all his stuff.
Chariots of the Gods, that guy.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he based all his space travel garb on the idea of a diving suit. And so because these things look like what, say, the Mayans and the Aztecs used to represent it, so he said they came there.
Mm.
Okay, but to me that's bogus. because we haven't been wearing the same stuff. We haven't been able to get further than the moon. I mean, when we went to Mars, the people didn't go there.
Right.
You know, like they sent little robots, and then they wandered around and got some stuff.
Uh-huh.
Now, when the people start to go to Mars, I mean, they are going to have a different garb, because it just that stuff isn't going to work, because it's clumsy, it's awkward, and since it on the moon where you have gravity is 1/6 what it is on Earth, it's okay to walk around there. You won't have your bones crushed, but if you have to wear the same thing on a higher gravity planet, nobody can move.
Right.
You know, there'll be like old geezers standing in one spot.
Right.
You know, waiting for the bus to come around.
You're right about that. Now, I think very few people think about that, myself included, when, you know, you think back about the moon landings and Neil Armstrong and whoever else bouncing around up there. They have these big, giant Michelin man suits on, and they can hardly... They can't even grab a flower if there were one there, because they got a big fat glove on, and this is with gravity 1/6 of what it is here.
Yeah.
So to
be on another planet is going to require an adaptation to that environment, which we haven't even considered.
Right. Something way beyond what we've seen.
Now, he died in 1943.
Tesla did.
Yeah, about 2 months before the government awarded him the patent for radio and robotics, because his boat, you know, his robotic boat was radio controlled, so he had to invent those things. And Marconi was getting the name as inventing radio, and he just stole 17 patents that were extant. That Tesla had done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nikola Tesla, he was something else. Well, okay, so what do you make about colonization of the closer realm? In other words, our own solar system, places that we don't have to move that quickly to get to. You know, speed of light travel is not even necessary to colonize, you know, around here. Is that something that you see, space colonies?
Well, I think one thing that could easily happen is Freeman Dyson's
Dyson sphere. Mm, yeah.
Because that
tell people what that is for those who aren't familiar.
It's like the Earth has an orbit from the Sun, in other words, a certain distance, which apparently is pretty good for life.
And
so if you then took the rest of the solar system and powdered it up, so you could use it. You could then create a shell that would be around the Sun at the orbit of the Earth. And therefore, you would get energy out of it, because you'd stick rods in it. It wouldn't have to be that thick, but you would live on the inside of it, like the old Hollow Earth theory.
Mm.
And you would have an enormous amount of land to work with, and since it would be so huge in diameter, that it would be like in the same way that on Earth, where we are curving convexly away from everything else, this would be curving concavely, if it's such a word, but it would seem so gradual. You'd still think you're on the flat Earth, only this thing wouldn't stop.
Huh.
And so that a larger and larger population could be accommodated.
Huh.
You know, because now all those things like the UN goes around saying that if we don't control the population, you know, by more automobile accidents, birth control, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, man-made viruses.
Yeah, that they would have, you'd have to lift up from the ocean floor 3 continents the size of Africa in order to have enough land to grow vegetables, so they have something to live on and eat. So that's obviously not what's going to happen, because if the population grows and grows, you're going to have like more and more wars that are going to be bigger, and then eventually people are going to wise up to that isn't going to help, because that's just continuous brutality.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to get to a place where you can spread out, you know, like the United States in its beginning was practically unpopulated.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, when you went west, it was because things were getting too crowded in the east. You know, and if you had funny ideas, you just moved on to a place where only people that had the same kind of funny ideas that you did would set up shop. And nothing would happen. But eventually, the people caught up and they started to fill in all the gaps.
Mm-hmm. Now the only way out is up.
Yeah, well, I mean, up in the sense of of finding new territory,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that living on marbles in space, which is what it means. I mean, like people even call the Earth a blue marble,
right?
You know, an Aggie, something like this, you know, and so that's being shown not to work after a while, because if we pollute all the water, you know, nothing's going to live with that one. Cut all the trees down, then you have no oxygen. So that there has to be more and more things going on that we have to have a worldview and a horizon that's faster than what we can do to spoil it.
Who was that? The Russian rocket scientist, I think his name was Siliosky, and he said, the Earth is certainly the cradle of mankind, but you cannot stay in the cradle forever.
Yeah, because you know what babies do in the cradle.
Maybe that's what it's like. Maybe the Earth is like a placenta, and we're using up sort of all the resources like a baby does as it's nearing term, and then it has to sort of separate from the mother before it, you know, in order to survive for both parties.
Yeah, well, that was the theory behind the movie 2001.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stanley Kubrick. Yeah.
Right. Now, what I'm talking about is easy to say, but very difficult to do.
Mm. Yeah.
But it's going to require an enormous amount of cooperation, because I think the world of science, as an activity of single individuals, you know, working in some place,
all specialized
mysteriously, you know, like that. You know, I think that's over, because as information starts to converge and various processes are going to converge into one thing, that you can't do it. So that's why I think that Teilhard de Chardin was correct when he talked about the noosphere. I know that recently people are trying to claim that Russians invented that. No, that's not true.
Yeah, Vernadsky, I think, is the Russian they're talking about. But, yeah,
right.
Chardin did it long before that, I think.
Yes, huh? and I noticed, my name showed up in Dazed and Confused, that English magazine, in the December issue. And they actually, they didn't do some fact-checking in the article, and they said that Teilhard de Chardin was an 18th-century philosopher. He was born in 1881,
mm-hmm.
and died in 1955.
Right, he was relatively current, yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly. And the interesting thing about him is he didn't believe that there were any people on other planets.
Really?
Which was the day that I said goodbye to him,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a mentor.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's weird. Everybody has their limits, sort of. And he was a Jesuit. I'm surprised we got as far as we got with him.
That's probably true.
Well, so the idea of extraterrestrial intelligence. The metaphor is people, but I guess he didn't believe that there were intelligent critters out and about in the greater cosmos.
No, I think he held a position that was very close to Dante's. That there were angels out there, you know, and stuff like this, and, and that
which there may be, but
I mean, the idea that humans are only limited as a species to the Earth. I think that was a big mistake to have said that.
And
he said that in a tea time conversation with somebody who wrote it as a footnote in one of his books. And he never actually declared it. So like somebody else said that about him. I don't know why the guy put that in the book.
We have this idea that the universe or the galaxy or whatever is somehow an impediment to life, and that it's that life is somehow relegated only here to Earth. But maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's just our understanding of the way life is. Maybe the galaxy is no barrier to life whatsoever. In other words,
no, I don't think so. I think we're made up of imagination. I mean, that I agree totally with William Blake. That's the best thing that we should lead with. And so once we give up the imagination through rote learning and altered discipline, you know, I mean that's when you start to die.
Cartesian thought. Putting yourself in a box, all that, Well, all right. I tell you what, let's take a little break here, and then we'll come back right around the top of the hour and talk some more, okay?
Okay, I'm going to have a drink of cranberry juice here.
Do it. Get some cranberry juice. I'm going to have a beer. It's New Year's.
Okay.
Happy New Year, by the way, Paul, and thanks for being with us.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you.
Sorry. All right, everybody, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My guest is Paul Laffoley. He's a wonderful artist, architect. You can find information about Paul on the web at laffoley.com, L-A-F-F-O-L-E-Y. .com. You can also find information at Laffoley Archive, LaffoleyArchive.org. Lots of great stuff on the web from Paul Laffoley, and it's a pleasure to have him back on the air with us tonight. LaffoleyArchive.com, by the way. Okay, it's Mike, and it is Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. Here's one from the Hoot and Howlers. This is called Walking in the Sand. Happy New Year to y'all in about 2 minutes here in mid-Missouri. And we'll say goodbye to 2007 and hello to 2008. It's Mike on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. In the Sand, the Hoot and Howlers from their new CD called Friends. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN, Columbia, 89.5 FM. It is now midnight, 2008. The first seconds now ticking by. Welcome to January 1, 2008. And as my friend Paul says, it's a year of renewal and a brand new start, and I hope that's the case. All right, Paul, hi. Thanks for sticking around.
Good.
Hey, you know, we made a joke back and forth before we came on the air for the last couple of days about Captain Midnight. Do you remember that comment?
Yeah.
I used to have the decoder ring, my Captain Midnight ring, and I had to ask you about it. What's your
story? Do you happen to own one?
I think I got one somewhere, yeah.
Because the form of it is it was Captain Midnight in the Secret Squadron, and the thing to get new information, it was called the Key-O-Matic Codograph.
Yeah.
And it has a key and a slot in it, and obviously you move that around, and that brought up a simple like A1 code. You know, in it so kids could think they were getting some new information.
Right.
But it was kind of nice. You know, it looked like that, and it was like it was America's fifth column to the Axis. You know, where they did secret things. So he was the first like CIA agent or something like that. You know.
Yeah, I love my Captain Midnight ring. I've got one somewhere for sure. We had like a little gang, and we all had one, you know.
Yeah, his Captain Midnight code name was given by a general who sent him on a high risk mission when the aviator returned at the stroke of 12, which is very connected to now.
Yeah, right? Yeah, there it is right now. Yeah. Okay. Since we're on the topic, sort of before the break, flying saucers.
Okay.
And I sort of mean this specifically as flying saucers, not other type of ET craft or UFOs or whatever. I'm interested in the saucer, the spinning disc sort of craft. Do you have any opinion or thoughts about
the
whole thing?
It's a I call the saucer the Klaatu came to the Earth.
Again, from the day the Earth stood still,
The Phanaton.
Mm-hmm.
It had to do with the connection between consciousness and mass, because at lower dimensions that we live in, we tend to think of life and death as a dichotomy. But if you go to a higher dimensional realm, those things start to come together,
mm-hmm.
and that's so that we in our future, we will go in and out of death.
Mm.
So they'll come back to life, and most religions use that concept as a way of capturing people's imaginations,
mm-hmm.
and so that the flying saucer has the same part. I mean, like if you look at the side of a flying saucer, it actually fits inside of the Great Pyramid of Giza. You know, the main thing where it's 52 degrees 51 minutes, or maybe the other way around. But anyway, when you make that and you come down to the 0.618 to 0.382 from the base,
mm-hmm.
which is not one third up. But it's part of the idea that there is a mathematics of death, and that it's like when you mature, you have those proportions all through your body, you
mm-hmm.
know, from the top of your head, you know, to the navel, to the ground, and then your fingers, the one flange is 0.382, the next one is 0.618 together,
right,
you know,
right,
and then they start
right.
to form the whole thing. Like the Fibonacci series,
mm-hmm, the golden ratio, all that.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And so, the people have mistakenly connected that with life, where it's actually for humans, it indicates maturity and therefore death,
hmm.
because you can't grow anymore.
You know, in the Lakota tradition, when a person dies, and I sort of have experience of this in a very tangible way, grandfather can die and come back as a crow or a hawk or whatever,
sort of
shapeshift or whatever.
Yeah.
How does that tie into this?
Sure, because like if you have a species that is able to utilize the life death moment for change,
mm-hmm.
then you can start to utilize a lot more time than you think you have, because like here in the West they say, well, you live a brief moment, and then you die and that kind of stuff, and then you never come back. So it's like that you had gone into a dreamless sleep, like before you were born and that kind of stuff, as opposed to, Hamlet in his soliloquy saying, but perchance to dream, there's the rub, meaning that there's something that goes on afterwards. And what that going on afterwards is the fact that consciousness and mass can unite and therefore utilize each other into not a life per se, which is the total separation of consciousness and mass, but another thing which is different than either of them. And therefore that produces the sense of reincarnation, because where do you go before you become reincarnated? It has to be someplace. but what that someplace is a condition in which consciousness and mass are completely continuous with each other.
Oh my gosh, remarkable.
And I think that's when people call flying saucers mind ships, like Tom Bearden,
mm-hmm.
that it really means that it has the capacity to manifest as mass and also the capacity to manifest as consciousness, but it can't do both at the same time. In other words, it has to flip on and off, mm-hmm. like the way we deal with communication as on off, zero and one, and that way. So that to have something that's both a zero and a one, it means that you have to go to a higher realm in order to have that.
Hmm. Do you have any thoughts about the Jungian notion of the flying saucer, that it was somehow a denizen of the superego that was designed to sort of erode faith in science?
Well, I think that he was flabbergasted with Orfeo Angelucci's book, The Secret of the Saucers. In 1955, Amherst Press, he was writing about flying saucers at the time.
Yeah, he wrote the book A Modern Myth Seen in the Sky.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So he was using, he still used the word myth in the old-fashioned sense, that it wasn't true.
Mm.
And so but then he began to recognize that a lot of people had the same thing. So that's where you get the an archetype from what he was talking
right,
about.
Right.
And so that's when a lot of people stay on that course, because it's easy to switch back and forth in your mind and not actually have to grasp the concept or believe it that mass and consciousness can unite.
Right. Well, eventually Jung, I think, accepted the fact that they were somehow physically real, right?
Yeah. And so therefore he did.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was from reading Orfeo Angelucci's book.
Huh.
And he declared it. No, it was like an addendum to his book, in which he said somebody had handed him this book, and this guy that I guess worked at worked for Boeing, and had claimed that he was taken up in flying saucers many times, and I heard him talk on what was called the Long John Neville show when I was in New York, WOR, because he was constantly interviewing Orfeo Angelucci, and he people thought that he was just drinking absinthe because he'd see these green spheres out of which came voices, and then eventually, you know, scantily clad women, you know, and other things like that, who were coming to talk to him, and you know, Venusians, they were bringing him aboard the ships, and so like Jung thought of his book as a complete religious text, like a Bible, and I think that's when he changed his mind and recognized the reality to those. Because he was somebody without any education at all, did everything that Jung did.
Right.
Who had a great education and the advantage of having been brought up under Freud.
Mm-hmm.
Who never understood women.
For sure.
but made a big, you know, he was proud of that, I think, too, when he did that, you know.
All right, let me ask you about artificial intelligence. And by that, I don't even know what I mean, because the more that I've analyzed that set of words, I think, well, how could there be such a thing? There's no such thing as artificial anything, frankly.
Yeah,
everything's real.
You're intelligent.
Right. So, but the idea of somehow machine intelligence or computer intelligence or an intelligence that one of the ones that interests me is something that might, you know, spontaneously erupt out of the primordial soup of the internet or something like that. But at any rate,
okay, well,
you know,
that's
all
part
that stuff.
What I would say, the mythology of evolution. Because evolution caught the day when it finally was developed, that everybody just keeps using the word. And so that if you find the right mixture, you know, and set something up like a super saturated liquid and then hit it with a pin at the right spot, then something will develop out of it.
And it's improbable what might develop out of it. Unpredictable.
Right. And then I think that there's a lot of artists that use the internet, you know, for artificial life and artificial intelligence, and they're the ones that actually started that, and so that they began to discover that something happened that they didn't have any control over.
Uh-huh.
So that the original notion of an artist like as a substitute for God, which Picasso began to object to in his own work, you know, because he was so powerfully known a cultural icon, that these people have gone to a point of where to be an artist is to be the most humble person, not the most prideful, and so the all the gizmos and activities that go on in the computer took over the whole thing. So it would be as if they were that they had created an alternative nature, and that's what gave people the idea that you could have an artificial intelligence that it happens the same way. All you have to do is change the initial ingredients. But the process was the same thing, so that it became an ahistorical phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Whereas I don't actually believe that. I think that everything, like Vico said, everything is history, and that so that you're completing creativity is a part of nature, and it's adding to nature.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go beside it.
Right.
You know, and you can't get behind creativity. I think this is where the mistake is being made, when people think that that if you have some kind of formula, that you can become creative. I remember when I first started as a painter in the early 60s, and I got into these, you know, when rock started to happen, and I got my artwork placed in places where they would meet.
Mm-hmm.
Kids would go there, and like the Boston Tea Party, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Kids would go there and look at my stuff and then ask the manager, what was my formula? And the guy says, what are you talking about? So what does he take? Is he always on acid? Is it, you know, mescaline, psilocybin? What did he take?
Right.
They say he doesn't take anything.
Uh-huh.
So they go away gnashing their teeth.
Yeah.
And the idea was that you could get behind creativity in a very objective way and induce its existence. Now that to me is an ahistorical thought. Which I think, I mean, a non-historical thought, and I don't believe that.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's talk. We've got some time here to talk about sustainable living. People want to talk more about symbiotic relationships between plants and nature
and
technology.
Right.
We're sort of there. We're talking about artificial intelligence, even though there is no such thing. But we are developing machines that are doing amazing things, and we some people think the machines are out of control, or the men and women that run them don't know what they're doing, and anyway, plants, nature, and technology.
Okay, want me to start now?
Yeah, please.
Okay, I think the first principle is, without plants, we're dead.
Right, everything comes from plants.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a panspermia throughout the universe that the seeds of plant forms can live under the most extreme conditions and travel great distances.
Yeah, mushroom spores for sure.
Yeah, and then hit the earth and then find an environment that's amenable to development and then start in business.
Mm-hmm.
And that so that we're in a sense no more than animals to plants, meaning that lots of times that plants like animals because they eat their seeds, then they move to other places, defecate the seeds, and then help to have them grow in different places. So that's why the plants like us.
Yeah, somebody said that animals are something invented by plants to help move seeds around.
That's it. And so that in doing so, the plant intelligence is probably higher than ours.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we have the advantage of an imagination, because basically once you've seen one tree, you've seen them all.
And the ability to make tools.
Yeah, exactly. And so that, but we never lose our dependence on plant life
to
survive.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that we're fooling around, and the plants said, okay, let them do it. You know, what do we care?
Mm-hmm.
That so we have our own competitive world to live in. You know, like a lot of plants send out poisonous gas. You know, to offset other plants that are coming along, you know, when they want to reach the sun,
right.
You know, so they die off.
Oh.
And so
they compete violently in some ways, you know.
They're moving around all the time.
Right. They just don't move the way we do.
They move really slow, and if you see movies of them, you see they gang up on a plant that has taken over a good spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this it has all the things that we think that nice plants shouldn't do.
Right. We have this idea that you know, it's just the mean monkeys that do this nasty stuff.
There's evil in everything.
But there is something different, though, because I have experiences in nature that although it is not particularly sentimental, there's something else there that we are sort of lacking right now. Maybe it's
respect or honor for other life forms that are giving up their life for you or something, but there's something different going on in the psychology of the whole thing.
Well, I think it's velocity. I mean, that if you had a group of people who could only move extremely slowly and they were moving away from you, you would say, if you speeded the movie up, you're running away from me.
Right.
Only that you could have no problem just reaching out and capturing them before they moved an inch. And so I think that's the condition of plants, is that the day that they pick up speed is when we got to watch out. And I know it sounds funny, but
it's true. Yeah. In a way, you know, people have this idea that, you know, how much intelligence does it take to corner a carrot, you know, or something. But
exactly,
you know,
yeah.
but the plants, you know, they can't run away from us. But what they can do is introduce, you know, secondary chemicals, secondary byproducts into the environment, and then they can sort of manipulate the environment.
Yeah, if you've ever been falling into a poison ivy patch, how powerful those things really are.
Right, and there are other ones like some of the psychedelic plants, like you mentioned psilocybin, and those are ones that sort of goose you along to try to help them out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they try to help you to get a better connection to the natural world.
The ego never dies.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, take the idea of ghosts. You know, when ghosts haunt a place, it means the body died, but the ego didn't.
Yeah, the spirit stuck around.
Yeah.
But by ego, what do you mean by that? In other words...
The power of the will to want to affect change. It's like life insurance is based on that. Yeah, you know, the father gets all his life insurance so that he can actually control his family after he's dead.
Yeah, still got the money.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, with regard to spirits and ghosts and this not, you said earlier in the program, and it was sort of off the cuff, but you said, you know, the universe doesn't care about us. We're just this little thing here in the middle of this vast sea of whatever. But what do you make of spirit? I mean, there are ancestors and all of this stuff that many people discount and say, well, you know, if you can't hit it with a hammer, then it's not real. And so when somebody dies, that's it, and they just become, you know, fodder for worms or what. But there are people that talk about the spirit world and that it's real and that the ancestors are just still who they were.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do that. In February, because I'm going to be in a show near Cologne in a museum.
In Germany?
Yeah.
Cool.
In which the title of the thing is called The Message. It's Art and Mediumship.
Awesome.
And so, in thinking about it, and I'm actually the only live artist in the show, too, which could be a burden, because I'm going to be surrounded by all these ghosts trying to get their thoughts in.
Oh, I bet it'll be fantastic. Yeah.
And so the word spirit seemed to me always to be a misnomer.
Hmm.
Because it has to do with breathing. You know, inspiration, expiration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, like, the Lord breathed into the clay and made Adam, you know, and this kind of stuff. And so that there's no other word for what people are trying to get after. In other words, they end up with a word that is very materialistic.
The breath word, yeah.
Yeah, right. And that the only way that you could possibly elevate it, you know, into some kind of 19th century jargon is to say that the point at which you change from inhaling to exhaling becomes a singularity in time, where you could go from time to eternity. So you're going from energy that's efficacious with motion and time to energy that's still in eternity, and you have a place to go back and forth.
Hmm.
I can accept that because I can understand the mechanics of that. But people who use the word spirit like a buzzword, you know, like, can you give me an amen? You know, you're in a church and something. So they're just using a word that people respond to emotionally and have no way to describe it.
Uh-huh.
You see, because I think there's a mind physics. There's a physics of consciousness. So there's a physics of spirit. And that those things all have to be investigated. It's been going on for a long time, but it ends up with the same payoff. I mean, it just doesn't really get beyond a certain point. Mm-hmm. And so people are told, well, you don't need to worry about that, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I worry about it because I think that you can do something other than what people have told you about that realm.
Yeah. You know, I always wonder about it because I have experiences that make me believe. Actually, that's not the word. I mean, I know that there's something going on.
Yeah.
I can't quite describe it well enough, and I've yet to prove to myself that I'm communicating in an effective manner with it because sometimes I think that I'm getting information that doesn't turn out to be particularly accurate, you know, or whatever. But I feel certain that there are messages that are being sent.
Right. And this is what I think is the function of dimensionality. That it's simply not a way to make mathematicians and physicists have a filing system for their formulas. That if we are said to live in a dimension, say like the third dimension, we know that there are natural inhabitants. We know about portaling in and out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to another dimension, there's got to be natural inhabitants in there. So it's like you go to the second dimension, you get shadows.
Right.
And so that in the Egyptian culture, the shadow was just as much a part of the personality as what we call the body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then they got into the bar and the car and the ark, and you know, and I think they came up with about 9 things that describe the human personality, which we don't have.
Uh-huh. But they were all components.
Because they recognized other types of dimensionality. Mm-hmm. than what we've got. And I was very disappointed the first time that I was involved in discussions about string theory, you know, with Brian Greene and other people.
Mm-hmm.
It began to be obvious to me that they're simply getting a system whereby that they are making their math work.
Right.
I mean it's self-serving. Mm-hmm. to a mathematician. Well, a dimension has to do with the nature of reality itself. So how can it be self-serving to a part of itself?
Yeah, the idea that somehow someone is going to come up with, you know, this particular fishy formula that somehow is going to describe the entire universe has always seemed silly to me. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's an arrogant position.
It's a power trip.
Yeah. No doubt. Well, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
About, and we'll get back to the sustainable living. We sort of got away from it a little bit, and I want to get back there because I think that there's a good possibility that there may be a time in the future where people are really going to need to learn to live in a more harmonic relationship with the other creatures that inhabit the planet, or including the plants, and either that or leave, you know, like we're talking about. Maybe. Earth.
Well, if we leave the Earth, which I think is inevitable, is that you're going to have a terraforming method.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't live in tin cans.
Right.
In outer space, you know, like Gerard O'Neill, you know, said we can make these things and spin around.
Right, these
inside.
Big space stations, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all you're going to get is a lot of seasick people.
Right.
Because the thing can't be big enough so that you get over the sense of motion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the day I heard of that one, I said, oh, my God, I nearly puked my guts out. just thinking about it. and so to do that for an entire generation till you get to some other place, no, it's not going to happen. So that like when you go to another planet, you want it like Earth.
Right, you want it nice, comfortable. You want paradise, yeah. Is what you want.
Well, not just paradise, but I mean, but something that we're used to,
mm-hmm.
and will because it, you know, like when they did the biosphere, they get caught up in certain things where one I can't remember what it was. There was one thing that went wrong, and the whole thing came apart at the seams.
Mm.
That the gases made it impossible to be in there, and so people were cheating, you know, going out a back door for a minute, taking a breath, and coming back in.
Right.
You know,
right.
And because they didn't. They thought that they could define a complete environment.
And they didn't realize the complexity of the whole thing.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to create that on another planet takes a hell of a lot of work and planning ahead of time, which is again not living on board a yacht. Which is what that was, you know, the biosphere was just a landlocked yacht.
Right.
And if you've ever lived any time on a yacht, that can become really stifling. And you know, like you want to beat everybody up that's near you because you just can't escape them.
Right, you got nowhere to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the trouble with the 19th century utopian intentional communities. I mean, they rarely lasted more than 7 years.
Hmm.
Because people just wanted to kill each other.
You know, it's wild because we have sort of the same theme that sort of keeps popping up, and it's this the idea that the human monkey wants to go. It wants to have places to go, to keep moving outward and have room and space to explore.
Yeah, outward bound.
And right now we've run out of that. But
right.
I have this conversation frequently with people about, you know, one of the biggest problems that we face or challenges is that there's adventure has sort of fled. And there's, you know, people watch Oprah because they got nothing else to do. And there's just...
No, they watch Jerry Springer.
Yeah. But you can no longer go into that hinterland and go explore the place where no one's ever been. People are now everywhere, and corporate marketeering follows. And
yeah.
You know,
we're on a crude and tasteless planet, and we want to get the hell out of here.
What do you think is going to happen? Do you think we're going to make it? I mean, do you think we're going to make it through this? Well, first, let me ask you this: Are we in a time now, in your opinion, that is different from times before, where we're critically at risk for you know, the future of our species?
Yeah, we had before, as I was saying, like Florence, the flowering of the Renaissance, had 30,000 people,
mm-hmm.
when it started, and it only got up to about 60,000 people a little later. That's nothing. That's a small town.
Right. I'm in Columbia, Missouri. We have 100,000 people here, and it's considered a little bitty town, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be in Florence, you'd know everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You can't know anybody. I mean, like, the more people there are, the less people you're going to know. So that's why people keep talking about the alienation in city living and stuff, and
mm-hmm.
and they want to get back to these little groupings of people. But there's no space left to do that. In other words, there's no place to run away. You don't have, like, in the 19th century in architecture, you had sulking rooms. You know like in shingle style architecture, where you had a consciously casualistic distribution of forms and space, meant the thing looked like it was put together from just a lot of scrap parts of architecture, and then you go inside of it, and there are little nooks that you can go in. You can get away from the other people that are in the house. So it was a perfect balance of privacy and communality.
Hmm.
I mean, the way we design architecture now, There is no privacy. It, in other words, in the notion of efficiency of spatial use, you simply have no privacy. And so therefore, tempers will flare, beautiful relationships will be destroyed, because people don't have a world in which they can commit to somebody else, because they're constantly being picked on and jabbed with pins and things like that all around them.
What do you make of the internet and its connection to this?
Oh, it's like Spider-Man. You know, like
Captain Midnight. Now we got Spider-Man.
Right? Yeah. No. But I mean, but it has that thing of where wherever you start in it, you're going to get caught in its web.
Mm.
And I mean, they call it the internet. It's like a spider's web.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really say much about anything, but it says a little bit about a lot of things. And so people think that they're knowledgeable by being involved with it, and so it's become a substitute for reading, which is probably one of the stupidest things that people could do, because when people stop reading, illiteracy begins.
It is weird that there's a shift in young people I see where it's a different language almost, where They don't read, as you mentioned. There's very little reading of books, but they communicate via the internet and use text messaging on their telephones,
right,
and all this stuff. But it is it's sort of an advanced. I mean, it's still communication, and a strange language is evolving there, I think.
Oh,
too.
It's like the Basque language. Hmm. The Basque language has no metaphor.
You mean that in Southern France and
in
northern Spain.
Between Spain and France.
Yes, so, uh-huh.
And they're famous for militaristic separatist activities.
Yeah.
They were planning on blowing up the Guggenheim Bilbao just because they didn't like it, you know. And they almost got away with it. Because I was there the day that it opened, and I was 5 minutes away from the gunplay between one of the Basque separatists and one of the local cops, you know, because they couldn't use the electronic devices, so they had all kinds of very simple incendiary devices,
uh-huh,
placed right at the edge of the roof protection. In other words, Frank Gehry does thin roofs. It wasn't totally complete, so I was able to measure the thickness of it. That thing is an inch and a half thick. That's a thin piece of architecture, a wall. You know what I mean?
It's inch and a half.
Yeah, nothing. So they could have just blown that thing right up 50 feet straight up in the air and tipped it over. And that would have been an interesting variation in it. But anyway, the Basque people speak like a military code. So no part of their speech is ever misunderstood for people that know the language, and very few people do. They're brought up in Bilbao, you know, they have street signs in both Spanish and Basque, and there are people who reach high levels of administration that simply cannot translate back and forth, because I remember at the opening. The first guy that spoke in Basque, and the, you know, like the universal translator that you stick on your head, that, you know, the guy said, "I'm sorry, I can't translate this. I don't know what the hell he's talking about." And what he was doing, I think, was simply cursing the whole project and the people in the town that allowed it to occur. But the thing is that to have a language that has no metaphor makes it impossible to translate it,
mm-hmm,
unless you're brought up with it,
right,
and that you're totally familiar with all the phonemes that have specific meanings. So it you add and subtract the phonemes to make your words, And so you can't, it's like computer language. It does not respond to vague human intention. No, a vague human intention is metaphorical. And so that as kids get imprinted with the computer lingos and what that is, that they will be a generation that will cut themselves off from their entire past. And then, of course, you know what that means then. You know, and anyone who doesn't know history is doomed to repeat it. So again, I say that the essence of being a human being is to understand its own history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, again, in a personal sense, I mean, the more that I learn about the past, the more I understand about...
how to act.
Yeah.
How to be moral. How mm-hmm. to... how to pass on wisdom to people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. All of this sounds like we're in deep, deep doo-doo, you know?
Right.
And there are people that are sending me emails and text messages saying, well, ask Paul about all the advanced technologies that we're not privy to that are being used and utilized by the military-industrial complex to strafe us into...
There's the answer. The military-industrial complex wants that kind of a language. So a military code. So the ordinary citizen will not be able to know what's being said.
Right. I've talked about this before on the air, that there's sort of a cryptocracy that they develop. That,
absolutely.
That, you know, there's a secret society that's built around language.
What was the Native American tribe in the Second World War?
The Apache.
The Apache. Okay.
Sure, the wind talkers, yeah.
Yeah, and so they screwed up all of the military codes. Well, it sounds as though that they've got to come up again with something that will go in and mess this whole thing up.
Hack the matrix.
Yeah, because in other words, to take a language that has metaphor embedded in it and break through a language that has no metaphor. Because a non-metaphorical language is by nature fascistic.
So that's one of the potential solutions.
Yeah, because basically most people love fascism. You know, it's easy. You get one guy to do all your thinking. And you just follow what he says.
Yeah, and if you're lucky enough and you play the right cards and you don't rock the boat, you can probably skate by.
Well, you could become the head fascist.
What about the average folk? You know, I mean, why is fascism so easy to accept?
Because it does not require any thinking.
Yeah, but what about, what if they're going to come and put a bullet in your head?
That's why people then start to wise up and then fight it off. And then the fascists can't understand it. Why are they doing this? Any fascistic regime will always sit by the side of the road and wonder what went wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody assumes that they're doing the most noble thing.
That's right. And yet, there's a lot of people that are totally evil. Mm. They don't even know it.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess that's the story of history in many ways, yeah.
I remember the first thing that Andy Warhol told me when I started to work for them, he said that you got to watch out because people are so evil. That was like his favorite phrase when he'd be walking around in his studio.
People are so evil.
Yeah.
Well, there's something weird going on because we're all still here, and the nuclear menace has been around for 60
That's right.
years now, and we've got all of these things that are supposedly going to put us out of our misery, and that's going to be it. But evolution or nature, it doesn't seem to me work that way. It seems that there's always a bootstrapping toward greater and greater complexity and connectedness,
And I have a hard time believing that this thing, even though there are maybe sometimes one step forward, two steps back scenarios, but I have a hard time believing that the whole thing is for nothing and that history is for nothing. It seems that it should have a purpose or an objective or some sort of a goal.
Well, we're here because we're not all there. I mean, that's what the Gnostics said. I mean, that the world is evil. It's the Tibble. And that we're a divine spark. And what we're trying to do is form a conventicle and get the hell out of here.
Maybe that's what the development of technology is all about. I mean, essentially, you know, there's an argument
that
says...
Well, its good side would be that. In other words, what it is, it uses the principle of the harmony, which means to create a perfection which will be so perfect that it will go by the observation of the archons. You know, the archons were the people who guarded the divine sparks that were thrust into the Tibble. And when anyone tried to escape... That they would throw him back and multiply his existence with a single blow.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have something which is perfect, it will escape their notice because they only have a degree of understanding of what that is. It's like we're actually doing stuff that's similar to that now in some of the experiments. Or for relativity that go on now on almost a daily basis.
Like what? What do you mean?
Well, in other words, like they take things like a fused quartz crystal, and they put it in a device so that it will become the roundest object in the world. Because up to a certain point in history, roundness meant something that was almost round. You know, I mean, just...
Right, nothing's perfectly round.
Yeah, and so even ball bearings are definitely not totally round.
Right.
Like, if you try to make them in outer space, they'll still have something as a result of being thrust out into outer space before they form in globules. But this fused quartz crystal... They make them by... They spend probably 10 years on a single sphere where it rotates inside this device where it removes, just like the littlest tiny part from it so that the thing compensates. And when you take it out of the device, it's almost impossible to see the thing. It's because... the human senses are incapable of appreciating that kind of perfection. So that if you can form a conventicle on that principle, it'll slip right by the archon.
Uh-huh. And then out into the greater whatever.
No, then you go back to the Godhead.
Well, maybe I can say maybe about everything, but I mean, is this... a story that you like? I mean, is this something that might maybe in process? Is this the process of history?
Because it's something that you can get a hold of. I mean, it's like it's a way in which that physics and metaphysics can be made continuous with each other, because most of that's why I say the word spirit and matter. Have to be made continuous with each other in the same way that consciousness and mass, can become continuous with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So if you load one up as equaling good and the other one evil, then you will go for one and eschew the other, and yet they have to work in tandem. So that I said to make a perfect sphere. A sphere that's so perfect that it becomes almost impossible to see it, because your eyes are not sensitive enough to appreciate some. In other words, it's like like dinosaurs can only see stuff that when it moves,
mm-hmm.
and so when a person stays still, it won't bite your head off.
Yeah.
So that a lot of animals have that one. So that means that we've reached a stage in our development where our senses work to a certain point. But if you want to go beyond that, you have to add something to the senses.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've been trying to work on a type of goggles that will enter, will make me see the fourth dimension. And how it is like my left eye has never seen the third dimension. In other words, the pinpoint vision never developed. So, like in my right eye, it's completely normal. But I have in every eye, there's a pinpoint vision, a normal vision, and a peripheral vision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in my left eye, you've got the normal, and the peripheral, which allows me to see three-dimensional things through the use of the pinpoint vision of my right eye. But I know that my pinpoint vision in my left eye has never observed the third dimension. So therefore, if I stick a pin in that connected with goggles and electronics like that, that could probably be trained to see the fourth dimension and skip the third.
I love it. Well, what is the fourth dimension?
Well, see, there's a fallacy in the way people have attempted to see it. They think that you have to have another third dimensional direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. In the same way, we actually live in the fourth dimension, not the third. And anyone who deals with dimensionality will ultimately have to admit that, because we see motion. So therefore our experience motion. So that you can't look at the third dimension the way Euclid did, in which it's now essentially the repository of most sculpture. You know, it's like Salvador Dali said when he saw a mobile, he said, "I thought the least we could ask of a sculptor is it not move." He was keeping the tradition that the third dimension is for art which is solid and doesn't move.
Right, right. As soon as you add motion.
Yeah, you're starting to deal with the way life operates.
Mm-hmm.
Because in anything, I mean, this is the way most people define life when they see something move. You can fool a lot of people. Like the Turing device, which was something moved, with sound, and then you could fake a situation where a person couldn't figure out whether the person talking was alive or not.
Right.
You know, in that way. So the sense of aliveness has to come from a much higher dimensional realm than we've even defined, and so to get to that requires new types of instrumentality.
I see.
That we haven't developed yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so this is something you're actually trying to create, an artifact that you can attach as a prosthetic device or something?
And the reason is that I've been assigned to do a tarot deck, and all the reading I've done about it, the various people that make them are trying to deal with higher dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the images that come out are simply three-dimensional dimensions. So it didn't work. And so I was trying to figure out how I would do it, and then what equipment I would need to do it.
Amazing. All right, hey, look, we're top of the hour. Let's take a break, all right?
Okay.
We'll come back and we'll talk for another hour.
Yeah.
Everybody, the wonderful Paul Laffley on the web at laffoley.com, laffoley.com, and also laffoleyarchive.com, laffoleyarchive.com. You can link to both of Paul's sites from my site over there at mikehagan.com. And, of course, You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. KOPN is on the web at kopn.org, all right? Okay, let's see. Where are we here? We are right about 1 o'clock, so good morning to y'all on the 1st of January, 2008. And we'll play a song here from my friends, the Hootin' Hallers, who are hooting it up down there on 9th Street at the Blue Fugue. Everybody having a good time down there. Hello to the people listening. And this is from a CD called Friends, and it is called You Lied. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll have Paul Laffley back with us in just a few minutes.
One, two, one. Well, you're the kind of girl that wears flowers and curls and damps any man that she meets. Well, I love my pride a few whiskeys ago, and I offered you a scene. You said, hey, shake yourself, don't take me home, and I drowned at you like a dog for a bone. Most in the morning, all I had was gone. Well, you lied, you lied, you lied to me. You're the meanest old bitch in Tennessee.
Columbia, 89.5 FM. That's the Hootin' Hallers from their new CD called Friends. And that song is called You Lied. And you're listening to it here on Radio Orbit. It's about 1:03 now on the first day of January, 2008. And we're lucky enough to have the wonderful Paul Laffley with us on the air for another hour or so, late into the evening there in Boston. What's going on there? You got crazy things happening in Boston, or is it just another New Year's Eve there, Paul?
It's 2 o'clock here.
Yeah, was there any...
They have this thing they've had for 20 years, which they call First Night,
yeah.
In which artists are supposed to do things, and it's become less and less viable. And they've done things like they franchise it to other cities. I can't believe that.
There's one here actually. There's one here.
Huh?
There's one here actually in Little Columbia, Missouri. I swear to God, they're doing it tonight.
So you guys pay Boston money?
They pay somebody.
Oh. No.
Yeah, I swear to God, and I was at a place earlier tonight actually where they used to be a participant in the first night thing, but they don't allow alcohol if you're involved in first night. And
yeah.
This little place that I was at said, well, now we decided we want to sell beer and wine, so we decided not to be in first night tonight. And I said, well, good, give me a beer.
No, I was involved in the first one.
The first night?
Yeah, and I knew all the guys that started it, and I used to get to do projects where they would pay artists money to do these things.
Uh-huh. And, I didn't realize it started in Boston.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I guess, like you say, everything turns into some sort of a marketing scam, you know?
Yeah, it's like franchising McDonald's.
Yeah.
You know,
unbelievable. They sell T-shirts, you know, and everything. All right, people commenting at the break that the tarot deck that you're involved in, everybody wants it. They say, when is he doing that? That would be awesome, Mike. Get more
information. I'm working on it now.
All right, so... when you get it done, you tell me so I can tell people, right?
Well, my gallery's on my back to get it done.
Kent Gallery in New York.
The people that threw some money at me to do it, they're constantly, you know, talking about when are you going to finish, you know, and stuff like that. So I feel like Michelangelo being yelled at by Pope Julius II, you know. Because that's what Pope Julius II would come in from lopping heads off of people and then come into the Sistine Chapel and say, you know, Michelangelo, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, what are you lollygagging?
Yeah, well, he took 4 years to do it, but Leonardo took 4 years to work on the Mona Lisa and never finished it.
Oh, man, I love Leonardo da Vinci, though. I think he's just amazing. All right, so anyway, the tarot deck, we'll let people know when you have it done, okay?
Right.
And is it just an art piece, or is it something that will be available?
No, in other words, I want it to be a divinatory activity.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've separated the major from the minor arcana with size, you know, so that one size, a unit, fits all the cards. But the ones that are the major arcana... it's 1.618.
Of course,
is the death mathematics, and the other one, the minor arcana, is simply double the square, you know, so that the minor arcana deals with free will, and the major arcana deals with fate, because everything is the antimony of fate and free will when it has to do with human beings.
Some people argue that free will doesn't jive with, you know, with the idea that the universe and God have a purpose for everything and that everything is sort of predestined.
Destined, yeah. Well, it's the same thing. In other words, the Greeks had the same problem. I mean that, you know, Oedipus Rex. You know, he thought he was acting with his free will, and then he ends up killing his father and marrying
his
mother.
Mom, yeah.
You know, and then there's no way that you can define one into the other, and so that makes a true antimony in the Kantian sense of an antimony.
That's an alchemical word.
No. It's just simply. A word that means that words have no function after a certain point. That although it sounds like a paradox, it's actually something where the unity of the two words cannot be expressed in words.
Okay.
But yet when they manifest, they manifest as something separate.
Yeah, it's hard to even get your head around it, sort of.
Yeah.
All right, here's another one that comes at the break, and again, related to what we're just talking about here. How do we move beyond history, Paul, if we rely on it forever as a crutch to avoid past mistakes?
Well,
again, another paradox, sort of. I mean, all we have is the rearview mirror. That's all we have to go on.
There is nothing but history. And people who assume that you can get away from it, repeat it. So that the only freedom in history is to know it so well that you can tell when junctures are coming up. Because, in other words, there are crisis moments, the kairos in history.
Right, the kairos point, yeah.
Yeah, and then once you begin to recognize those, you then you can do something about it. It's like when I went to college, I studied classics and art and philosophy, and it was great to know a whole civilization from beginning to end that was already over, you know, the Greco-Roman world.
Right.
Because you then knew all what everybody does.
Yeah.
So it's like if you get stuck in some specialized thing, you don't realize that you're reenacting history, and you could be you're like the fool in the tarot deck. Hmm. You could be walking off the cliff.
Yeah.
You're carrying all your belongings in a little satchel over your shoulder.
Right.
And even a little dog barks at you, like, said, "Watch out for that thing." So that the only way, it's only by history that you can maintain your humanity, because it recognizes when the human imagination's at its peak, and when it's at its nadir.
And you feel we're close to or at one of these kairos points.
They're always there, but the thing is that some are more kairotic than others. You know, I mean, it's that funny way of thinking about it is that
everything's always changing, yeah. But sometimes it changes greater than another time.
Right.
So,
yeah. And so the time operates like in a spiral, and sometimes the diameter of the spiral grows larger, and other times it grows smaller, so mm-hmm. that you can. It looks like a sine wave going along, and that in other words, it becomes more and more complicated. If you start with a Klein bottle and run all of the historical analysis over, through a Klein bottle, you'll get a much more complex view of history, and closer to the imaginative reconstruction of the past that you want to get at. In other words, you'll never run out of history, meaning that you can't do a period and then say, "Well, I can forget that now. I want to go on to the 18th century." You know, where sometimes you see books like The Age of Faith and The Age of Enlightenment and The Age of Reason and
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are false history. Because you're assuming that everybody was in lockstep, you know, during that time, and then suddenly when a date happened, you changed everybody's worldview changed overnight. No, that's not true.
Right.
And so the enrichment of the investigation of the historical fabric never stops. It can never end. But the thing is that you can reach a point where you can actually gain some wisdom, and so your further investigation has a body of wisdom that starts to accumulate.
And a lot of it, I think, and maybe you could tell me if you agree or not, but pattern recognition, you know, the more you know history, the more you can see, before.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, pattern recognition is probably the other side of imagination, because you've got to imagine something, and then you've got to recognize that it has a pattern,
mm.
so that it becomes useful.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have an idea, you just get an idea, and people say, "Well, that's stupid," you know, because you have no way to apply it. With pattern recognition, you can figure out how to apply it. The next day, you come back, "Well, it's good for this, this, and this." The guy says, "What? I never thought of that.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, so that it creates the surprise to a new idea, so that you can be in the presence of the authentically new when you use the process of pattern recognition.
All right. What are your thoughts on magic?
Okay.
And let's define it first, I guess.
All right. Well, it's a non-rational method of engineering.
That might be the greatest definition I've ever heard for magic.
Well, I mean,
non-rational method of engineering.
Yeah, it's the simplest. I mean, lots of people have said that it's a form of engineering whose principles are fallacious. You know, I mean, you get that in the 19th century, but I don't think that's true because it's actually a form of engineering that comes from a higher dimensional realm. This is why I keep going back to dimensionality as a way of understanding things, and so that how consciousness and mass come together and manifest together is what people would call a magical manifestation or an act.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of the so-called rational engineers work from mass, you know, and then they measure it and do other things to it, you know, and all this kind of stuff, and they build bridges and everything. And, you start to get a combination of that during the Middle Ages, you know, building cathedrals.
Mm-hmm. Which is a remarkable thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you take some of the flying buttresses were literally magical acts, because what those guys did with stone, no one could do.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would build those things monstrously high and utilize the forces in the most delicate interconnections so they could say to the populace, that's up there by faith.
Mm.
In other words, it's not because to them at that time, reasonable engineering was very close to what the Romans did, who were probably the greatest engineers with the most limited materials that ever hit the earth, and so that the magical part is you're trying to push the engineering beyond what people think about, so that it doesn't have in other words, it doesn't seem so inevitable in what you're doing. In other words, it doesn't seem, you know, so tied down to earth. I mean, the first person who makes the viable an anti-gravity device will be considered a magician.
Yeah, you make me think of the flying saucer again.
Yeah, right.
I mean, this is the archetype of that thing that you're
exactly,
talking about.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And the thing is that once that becomes a greater part of our culture, we won't, the word magic will disappear.
Mm-hmm.
It'll just be a part of our culture, which will then look back on I suppose a non-magical world and wonder why it didn't happen sooner.
Right. So magic in the sense of an engineering form that's actually efficacious, that actually works,
yeah,
in the hands of a good magician, sure, right?
Because it makes the bridge between the subject and the object. Because like magic involves the human will.
Mm.
So that you will something into existence. It's like in in Snow White, you know, when the Wicked Witch comes to the door and Snow White's sweeping out the junk that all the dwarfs did on the floor.
Yeah.
And she says, you know, she's one of the incarnations of the queen, you know, who's getting jealous of her, you know, and said, "Now, my beauty, just eat this apple." And she says, "I don't see any apple." Apple just pops into the the witch's hand, you
right,
know,
right.
And it's filled with poison, so she'll go to sleep.
Right.
And so you get right into Sleeping Beauty. And the thing is that if you could do that, if you could pop something into existence, you would a person who didn't know any better would say that was magic.
Right, right.
It's just an engineering with an alternative form of principles that are not normally used.
Mm-hmm. I think it was it Arthur Clarke who said something like, any sufficiently advanced technology will appear as magic to those unfamiliar with the technology. Something
yeah,
like that.
Arthur Clarke. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's what he was talking about in acculturated definition of magic, which has a history behind it, as opposed to people who think of magic as an alternative to history.
Hmm.
And yet it's really not true, because if it was literally an alternative to history, we'd never know it even existed.
Right. I mean, much of history is rooted in magic and alchemy and all these strange esoteric mystical ideas. Seems like only in the last 500 years or so, we sort of really got away from it.
Well, we didn't get away from it. It was good stuff.
Well, what is happening now? I guess maybe it's a sort of a real dichotomy, because you're right. There's a whole lot of it, more than ever. But at the same time, there's a real a backlash or whatever, or I don't know what the word is, but against it, to totally renounce and deny.
Well,
and
it's secular humanism. I mean, I've had people attack my paintings.
I was going to ask you.
Who were secular humanists and atheists, and then also people who I know were actual magicians.
Hmm.
Because one... That they didn't like what I was saying, and the other ones were saying I was giving away the secrets.
Well, that was one of the questions that came up, is that do you use magic? I mean, do you consider yourself, and you know, I don't even want to ask that. I mean, because most magicians or shamans or medicine people,
yeah,
or they would never call themselves that. But do you use techniques of that sort? Are you inspired by that sort of thing when you paint and when you design and when you do architectural work and this sort of thing?
Yeah, because that's what, like psychotronics, mind-matter interactive devices, that would be traditionally defined as a magical act. You know, a machine with no moving parts.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're recognizing that you can manipulate power without there being a clue that it's going on.
Right. No movement or manipulation. Yeah.
Because normal engineering, like, dotes on the operations of things.
Yeah, things have
you
to move.
You see something moving, then you say, well, that's like a clock operating.
It's broken. It's not moving. It ain't broken. I work in a manufacturing environment during the day, during the week, and let me tell you, if it ain't moving, it's broken.
Right.
Either
okay.
That or someone needs to be looking for a new job because they didn't push the button or whatever to get it going.
That's it. I mean, that's a very traditional way of separating yourself from the magical world, right?
Huh. Wow. Well, there seems to be magic everywhere, though, if you're paying attention.
That's right.
It's something that's that doesn't come and go. It's there. It's a matter of perception, maybe, or
because it is. In other words, it is part of the history of engineering, so what are you doing when you say, okay, I want to make an apple appear in my hand without having to grow off a tree, you know, and all that kind of stuff? It just pops into existence. Then you say, okay, and I need that apple for some specific purpose, and no, I don't need the apple tree. Or I don't need the orchard or any of the work that went involved to do that. You know, and I just wanted it to pop into my hand.
Right, the apple.
Yeah, and so that's the part of the magical process.
That's like Star Trek. You know, they walk up to the little thing in the wall and say they want an apple, and it makes an
exactly.
apple.
Exactly, yeah.
is that something you think that we're moving towards with this idea of molecular manufacturing and nanotechnology and all that? I mean,
because I think that now the people that are doing that, like say the Star Trek world, you know, which I don't know, does that actually exist anymore? Are they still making movies?
I don't know.
Or is it all over?
I don't know if they still do. I think there's an ongoing series, if I'm not mistaken. But I think that the sort of core stuff, I think, is done for the most part.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's been inherited by some new
Spock
writers.
Spock is the geezer and a half at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, and Gene Roddenberry, who was a pretty interesting guy. You know, he's long gone.
Yeah.
But they touched on some pretty interesting stuff and. I don't know, the whole holodeck thing I've always thought was pretty interesting, that you could just sort of create a virtual world of using lasers, essentially, and,
They were doing magic without any religious overtones.
Hmm, yeah.
So it would be as if, in other words, what would be the technology of an atheist?
Hmm.
I think that's what they were really presenting to the world, because atheists have to do stuff. You know, they just can't sit there and say, "Well, I'm an atheist," and then have no job and no activities.
Right, they still have to participate in the world. Right.
Right? Yeah.
Well, I wonder what God has to say about that. I mean, if there is a God, it's weird. I think about it in a couple of different ways. You know, the God, you know, who hung the stars in heaven, like
decorating a Christmas tree,
or just powers that are so greater than you that you may think of it as a God. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Either way, it seems like there's probably something like that somewhere going on.
Well, that's a very deistic position, actually.
What do you think about it? Just curious.
Well, I think that all our models of divinity are lacking something. I mean, it's not an agnostic position. I mean, because in agnosticism, you've got only two things. You've got dogmatic and methodological agnosticism, which is really like the child's mind wants to know something.
Yeah.
You know? And so that the thing of like defining a divinity from the point of view of the creation isn't really doing much, because it's always going to be self-serving to the created part. So I think you can't you really can't get your mind around that at all, and that's the way like most thinking Zen Buddhists go through the whole thing of like the outsiders. They look like atheists, but from the inside they're trying to figure all this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a way of approaching it. But other religions have the same point. I mean, this is what the practice of mysticism is all about. That, when you say neti-neti, that doesn't mean you're a Hindu doing that. It means that not this, not that. You know, like that you can't define it in a simplistic chop logic fashion.
Mm-hmm.
That you've got to you've got to keep your mind growing. I mean, keep the imagination expanding, even though you eventually lose the content to yourself. Whereas is that for a while you thought they had the content, but if you keep the process going, you're going to enter a realm of awe,
mm-hmm.
where you pass through the good to the sublime,
mm-hmm.
and so that you can't say what it is that you're after, but you know that you're getting close to it.
We talked earlier about dreaming, and you made a comment real earlier in the program about how some people who may not have dreamt for a long time and all of a sudden begin to dream again very vividly and have profound dreams. I wonder if you're a dreamer.
Yeah, well, that's actually what happened to me. that how that started was that after I got through college, I went I became really depressed and of a nervous breakdown, and so what that means is my psychiatrist said what you are is in a state of total depletion of your nervous energy. In other words, the energy that runs your synapses and all this kind of stuff was gone, and you're just about making it from one day to the next. So he said, I'm gonna help you out. So he gave me 8 shock treatments in 2 months. And what those are is that you have an electrode on one side of your frontal lobe and an electrode on the other side, and he runs 90 degrees direct current through your frontal lobe. Now, people usually thought at that time that it was like Ken Kesey's story of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, he said, no, that play was totally fallacious. What it does, it gives you a profound sleep that you cannot attain on your own. You know, people who are insomniacs, begin to have a destruction of the nervous energy for the same reason. You know, if you stay up late for a month, you're going to be totally insane. if you could possibly do it, and very few people can, but some people can do it for a week or something like that. Okay, so these things would send me so far below the REM cycle that I wouldn't dream.
Hmm.
And then after they were over, I began to dream, and then you have a rebound effect. And so you have incredibly vivid dreams where the scenarios are just like a movie, where you see all this stuff. Now I met a doctor who's my current doctor who said that I can give you a drug that will suppress your REM cycle and you could get that stuff back again. But I said, I don't think I want to do that. Because what happened is that when I came out of it, I also lost any inhibitions. And so one day, I used to live in Belmont. It's a suburb of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small town. Again, a 30,000 number of people there.
Right.
And so I'm walking along the street, and there was one house that I didn't know anybody in the house, because usually you know everybody around you.
Yeah.
And it was the summertime, and the screen door was there, you know, but the door was open, you know, some air would come through, and I smelled broiled chicken being cooked and then placed on the table. So I said, wow, that's my favorite food. I'm going to walk up to the door, open the door, and I sat down at the dining table and started helping myself to this big, all this chicken and everything, and eating it. And across from me were two kids that were nudging each other and laughing their heads off. The mother at the right side of the table was motioning to the husband to get on the phone and call the cops.
I love it.
Which he did. And I was taken to the, you know, to the local police station, and my father had to come down and get me, and then apologize for 2 or 3 weeks to this family that I wasn't, a murderer or something was coming into their house.
Oh, I love it.
But the thing is that at that point, I saw nothing wrong with doing that.
Right, I understand.
And so it was just by dumb luck that I didn't do something more stupid than that, you know. But I knew if I was ever in a position like that, I might not have been that lucky. It's like people who drink where they blank out.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they're still walking around and doing stuff, and they have no idea of what it is.
Right.
So that's a dangerous position to put yourself in.
Let's see, here's one that comes from the web. ask Paul about using his paintings as portals for dimensional travel. We've been talking about dimensions a lot.
Yeah. Well, I do that all the time. I'm not kidding either.
Well,
that,
how so?
That I make them as inventions, so that but they're inventions with no moving parts, and so the portaling to other dimensions is exactly the right word, because if you just assume a dimension and you don't have a portaling system, then it's no good. It's like just being a mathematician who uses dimensions as a filing system.
Hmm. So give me a little bit more of an idea about the methodology, how
okay.
you do it when you actually, you know.
Well, I mean you can touch them. You can look at them.
I know with Thanaton you actually have the positions
yeah, right,
for the hands,
yeah.
right?
But like I have one that's that is taken off from a psychotronic generator, where I've translated all the parts like the electronic parts into two dimensional forms, you know, like the. Like a variable capacitor. You know, I have a way of doing that. Then a choke system and resistor, a battery pack, a potentiometer, and then like a coil is probably the easiest one to represent, where you actually have a wire shape of a coil going inside itself, so that you never cross any of the wires, so that you actually see a coil turned into a two-dimensional form. So that means that then when you look at it, you are then controlling it in the same way that, like, in the book Flatland by Edward Abbott, you know, said that the three-dimensional sphere was able to look into the world of the Flatlanders and see what they were doing.
Hmm.
And so you're doing that to the forms. And by doing that, you can apply your will to act in very highly specific ways. Because usually if you can't increase the specificity of activity, then the thing isn't going to work as you want. So that you have to make sure that what you're dealing with is able to deal with the type of specificity that you want it to act with.
Mm-hmm.
So that you have to be very careful in designing the components so that they are literally two-dimensional forms.
Mm-hmm.
And so that works with the flatness of a painting. As long as it contains something that's involved with a ferric compound, you know, like, say you can do this with ink, you know, because like India ink has a ferric compound in it, that you can just draw these things, And they will activate by themselves.
Hmm.
because you're looking at it and you're acting with it, and there's a thing they call a rubbing plate, where you have a witness coil where you put something on the top of it, and then at the other end you rub that part and you wait until it feels a little sticky, and then you know you've made contact with something. So then if it doesn't work that well, you got to modify the thing. So it's going back and forth. It's like making a printed circuit. as a matter of fact, I'm trying to remember the name of the guy that did the canticle for Leibowitz. You know, where after the big one was dropped, And everything's decimated, then the Catholic Church reforms, and so this monk goes wandering out and he finds a printed circuit sticking out of the ground, and he comes back to the monastery and it's treated like the Book of Kells, you know, like so that you've got an interweaving of things and it's all flat. So I always thought after reading that that you could take the Lindisfarne or the Book of Kells and actually make those into electronic printed circuits and see if it produced coherent information. Because that would be exactly what it was. Now that was something that was anti-perspective. You know, like when you look at a lot of activities and work by people during the medieval periods, you didn't see perspective the way you found in the Renaissance. So you didn't see depth.
Mm-hmm.
But you saw things in real positions, and like it was, they thought that you could go up in space and measure the universe with a ruler. Like when Dante was describing the universe, he said it's 64,000 miles in diameter.
Right.
And you know, when people first come across that in the poem, he said, "What the hell is this?" You know. It's because we have such a loose definition of space and its increments, you know. To do that is amazing, you know. Mm-hmm. Like because you could do that to the Earth, you know. Say it's 8,000 miles in diameter, and then all the things that were added on when you went up to the celestial rows, you hit 64,000 miles in diameter,
right.
And that was the end of it. so that again. You had this very practical engineering-esque thought process connected with something that other people would define as the essence of the spirit. So that's why I always connect engineering to spirit to produce magic.
Right. And it doesn't always have to be engineering the way we sort of define it in the orthodox sense in the West here, moving parts, machinery, all that.
And this kind of stuff. Yeah. Like bridge building.
Yeah. All right. Time travel.
Okay. First of all, there's no such thing as time travel.
Because yes, again.
You don't travel through time. You endure through it.
Mm.
So that you travel through space. Because you have movement and station points, whereas through temporality, you have possibilities and manifestations.
Right.
Those are like the things. So a time machine is equivalent to a space machine. You know, in other words, that. The two things have to work together, and what I've done about that is that I think of it as a combination of lucid dreaming, near-death experience, out of the body experience, all those various things, which are where you can mechanize consciousness. In a specific way, and so if you use those as techniques plus structured singularities, you'll be able to access information alien to your own present without messing those other periods up. You know, because like that anytime anybody says time travel. They think, well, you're going to go back in time, and you're going to have the butterfly effect. You know, you're going to screw something up,
right,
and it'll change the entire world.
Right.
Whereas that's not necessary at all. And since you don't want to do that, you're actually causing your mind to go. And then if you want to access information, say 50 million years into your future, you're going to be faced with a worldview gap, where the average worldview used to last 75 years.
Mm-hmm.
Put it like that, you know, a person's lifetime. Now, 5 years. could be 1 year. You know, I mean, that with greater and greater communication, I mean, people, you know, have worldview gaps all over the place.
Right. Things.
You know, you go out for a corned beef sandwich, you come back, and there's a whole new worldview going on.
Right, and everybody's got their own idea and all kinds of different ideas. And
right.
And nobody believes the same thing.
Yeah, and so you've got to have a device which accepts the possibility of the change of worldviews as a necessary element. Now I call in my own design, I call that device the agnosticon. It's the capacity to believe or disbelieve a proposition instantaneously. And so that even if you say, like, you want to go 50 years into your future, there's going to be a lot of different things happening.
Oh,
and so the ability to even recognize the changes, if you were presented with them in a chop logic thing, like you were just taken out of your time and moved 50 years ahead, without anything in between, you wouldn't be able to appreciate it.
I mean, you couldn't even handle the information.
Exactly. So that you've got to have a device which does to you what nature does to you, only you want to do it faster.
Yeah, allows you the capacity to understand.
Right. So that you gain the new insight faster, and then that's affecting your brain. And then so that you can actually appreciate when you see something new.
Right.
It's like it. A lot of guys come in here and said, you know, it says, what's new in art? And I said, you've been looking at it for 10 years and you didn't recognize it. It's because they don't have the concepts in their mind to connect to the percepts.
Mm-hmm.
Of the sensation.
Nice.
And so there's no perception.
Right. I understand.
So once they get the concept, it's, oh yeah, that's true. That's something going on there. And so you have to have a device that does all of those things.
What about
so already you see it becomes quite complex and very costly too.
What about going backwards? I guess, for lack of a better word, I mean, going into the past.
Well, what it is like there's two things.
Or is that just like
it's like you've got retrocognition and precognition. I mean, retro perception of the past and pre-perception of the future.
And you still need that framework, I guess. Yeah. All right.
Oh yeah, no. You do it. In other words, that if you try to jumpstart yourself, you're going to think you're a new person.
Right. If you try to jump,
you won't have the memories in between.
Uh-huh.
And so that's often why people who remember their past lives, I think, are using a time machine and they don't know it, and so they built a religion over it.
Mm-hmm.
And that so that you've got to have a continuity. That's the one thing that I emphasize, that we're moving into the Bao Haroque, which deals with continuity in the same way that the Baroque period dealt with continuity. You know, so there are certain large things in history that come back. And that if you can't know things in a continuous fashion, you simply will be ahistorical yourself, and you just be shocked all the time. Whereas that so that you'll be in other words, what you want is a combination of déjà vu and jamais vu. I mean, déjà vu is having seen before, and jamais vu means never seen before. And so when those two things get blended together, you've got the experience of time travel.
I see. All right, here's one for you. Paul,
okay.
Do you imagine a quote-unquote hacking of the Matrix, as you and Mike mentioned earlier, in order to remove the current power structures of the day, the fascists, etc.?
You mean, do I take the blue pill or the red one?
I guess they're saying, what do you think is going to be, do you think something's going to happen to shift the apple cart, to stop what's currently happening and bring about something new?
Well, no, I mean, there's no such thing as a revolution or an evolution, because they define themselves to each other.
Hmm.
You know, they say, like, evolution is slow revolution. A revolution is a speeded up evolution, you know, and that kind of thing. I don't think that actually has nothing to do with history at all. And it was a 19th century concept developed to, to push or sell progressivism to people. What was the question again?
Well, just, do you anticipate any event or series of events that would bring down, you know, the current power structure, sort of like the Roman Empire was brought down by, you know, Christianity or something? Yeah. I don't know, you know.
Oh, that of course I think is inevitable, that we're on the brink right now. Mm. and that we only, since everything is kind of speeded up, that we have reenacted the Roman Empire.
Mm.
I mean, I think most like Christian religions have been preaching that for years out on the street with chalk and blackboards.
Yeah, the end is nigh.
Yeah, know what I mean? But the idea that a civilization can end and pinpoint how it happened. I mean, it's funny, because many times when you come up to those people and say that you were responsible for getting rid of the Roman Empire, and then they just go out of their skull. and the thing is that they don't accept the idea that what they do has negative effects, because there are a lot of things about the Roman Empire that were really good. It was one of the few times in history when they had civilization.
Yeah.
They had toilets, they had plumbing, they had heating.
Yeah, running water.
They had fresh water. People would take baths. I mean, when you get to the Middle Ages, the average time a person took a bath is they get caught out in the rain.
Right, you know, when they got married, maybe, yeah.
Something like that, you know? So that today, I mean, like, the average person takes a shower a day.
Yeah,
times
yeah.
Seven.
Amazing.
Yeah. And so that world, which is what Rome was headed for, if they had been allowed to continue, would have produced the quality of civilization that we have now. it's just that it got bad press because Christianity won.
All right, Mr. Paul Lapley, I'll tell you what, we got a minute or so left just to sort of wrap it up, but you're wonderful as always. What do you got going on that you want to tell people about?
Well, I said my next thing is my gallery, said I'm going to start my European campaign.
And this is Kent Gallery, of course, from New York.
Yeah, in New York.
Right.
I'm going to the Museum of Bochum, which is just outside of Cologne.
Yeah, Bochum,
I'm
going to
speak
it.
There,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
And then and be one of the 23 artists in the show, the only live one, and then I'm going to move on to the home office of the Anthroposophical Society in Dornach, Switzerland, Rudolf Steiner.
Yeah.
One of the really great buildings in the world.
Oh, I love
Rudolf
Steiner.
I'm dying
Steiner, yeah.
To have a show there, and I mean those people. Now there's a group of people that are totally paranoid and have a lot of trouble with Americans. I remember I visited twice, and I'm going in the trolley from Basel to Dornach, and people would just turn around and stare at me. Like, how dare you exist in the same time period as I do?
God.
You know, that kind of thing.
Well, that should be a thrill. Steiner was just amazing.
I know it. And then after I get through that, at the end of the week, Doug, that's my dealer, and I are going to go to that castle that was designed by the Mad King Ludwig II. You know, the one that...
Neuschwanstein.
Yes, so,
yeah.
You know, it was used by Walt Disney.
Yeah, I've been
there. For the Enchanted Castle.
Oh,
like
God,
that.
Well, we'll have to talk about it. I used to live in Germany, and I speak the language, and I've been to all those places, and yeah.
Oh, my God, I wish you could go with me.
Oh, man, you'll love it. You'll have a great time. We'll talk about it afterwards, okay?
Okay.
All right, Paul, we will do this again for sure. Enjoy the new year in 2008. I wish you the greatest of luck, and I appreciate all the time you spend with us, and we'll talk again soon.
I love
right?
doing it. Okay.
That's awesome. Take care.
Okay, bye.
All right, cheers. Bye. Everybody, the wonderful Paul Laffley on the web, www.laffoley.com, laffoley.com, or laffoleyarchive.com. Thanks so much for listening tonight to the program. We got Ruth coming up with Crash Landing for another bunch of good New Year's music, and we'll have Jonathan Zapp with us next week on Radio Orbit, same time, same place, 11 p.m. on Monday night, the 7th of January, all right? And here she is. Come on in, Ruth. I love you. Woo! Happy New Year. And let's see, one more from the Hoot and Howlers on the way out here. This one is called Blueberry Hill. I love y'all. It's been a great year, and I hope we can continue on with more of the same and better as we move forward in 2008. Take care, and stick around for Crash Landing with the good old Ruth.
I will headbutt you till the sun comes out.
All right.